In an era of Me Too, women are proving to be resilient than ever. We are now challenging long-standing patriarchy that has defined the current world as we know it. From Kamala Harris being declared the first woman to hold a position of vice president in the United States of America, all the way to a young African girl on the continent getting to know her value, we are indeed taking up space. It is in this first episode of Because It's There that we explore what it means to own your own light as a woman, as well as to lead. Today is a big deal. I have a woman who has led by example in her chosen field. She is, of course, Miss Metsi Maketa. Metsi has over 25 years of experience working with multilateral institutions and leading multidisciplinary teams supporting political institutions, political transitions, facilitating development programs, and delivering humanitarian agency services. In 2016, she was appointed the United Nations representative in Burkina Faso. In this capacity, she is the official representative of the UN Secretary General and is responsible for ensuring coordination and coherence of UN operations in Burkina Faso. Within the continent of Africa, she has seen it all.
Because It's There with Sarah Kumalo is proudly sponsored by Vuma. Connection lies at the heart of everything Vuma does. It drives important conversations, brings communities together, and creates opportunities for greatness. Connecting Africa's women empowers them to be extraordinary, and we are here to do that. Visit vumatel.co.za for more.
We are going to start by playing a little game, Metsi. Fill in the blanks. Life during the pandemic has made me more.
So life during the pandemic has actually made me to be more rooted in my inner capacities for care and compassion. It also made me to be deeply connected and attuned to the full gamut of my leadership capabilities. I happen to be among those who had to lead, galvanizing our teams who were supporting epidemiological surveillance and coordinating with our global logistics to ensure that testing, reactants, and PPEs are deployed to the countries where we serve. So in my case, it was Burkina Faso. I had to show up every single day for every single member of our team in a context where we had no reliable map and no reliable data, but we really had to stay the course.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing. Your name, Metsi, is a powerful one in that it means water, literally. Water natures. Water keeps things alive. Is there a story behind why you were given such a powerful name, Metsi?
Very few people, if at all, have asked me the meaning of my name, and you so aptly captured what it means. I always tell people it means that which gives life. So just a brief background. I am named after my grandmother from my mother's side. My grandmother, born in Botswana, a country that you know is still water stressed. My mom tells me her mother, who is my grandmother after whom I am named, was trained as a social worker and always fully available to the community, offering her services to every family that needed support. So in that sense, she was life-giving. She continued to be nourishing. She tells me, my mom that is, that when I was named after my grandmother had just passed away, and it was important for my mother to always remember the value that my grandmother carried, and that had to be passed on to me. And today, how I embody my name is that I express it through its unique and high adaptive capacity. Water is one of the rare elements of nature which can exist in three phases without losing yes. its essence. So I always say, you know, water has flow, it has adaptive utility, and is life-giving. And that's how I embody my name today.
That is so powerful and so eloquently put. Thank you for sharing that. Water is one of those resources that the world needs to actually take care of to sustain coming generations. So thank you. That is powerful. And I absolutely love how you've encapsulated it and how you embody it in everyday life as I know you. So As a scientist, Ameti, one of the things that fascinates me is the fact that you've moved from science to humanitarian. When did you decide that humanitarian work was your dream?
The first is, growing up, I have always wanted and known that I want to live a meaningful life. I had also realized that living a meaningful life did not only limit itself to monetary success. I would carry both being able to have a career that would offer me an opportunity to take care of my life while at the same time impacting humanity. Now, how I ended up with the United Nations, I was in the laboratory in the US. Doing a postgraduate, which is a master's level scientific research on how to reduce atmospheric carbon dioxide. It was in the early 80s, and at that time, only the scientific community was talking about the depletion of the ozone layer and the heating of the earth because of the amount of atmospheric carbon dioxide. So I was asked to find a protocol for extracting and stabilizing an enzyme found in plants that is responsible for fixing carbon dioxide. And the basic idea was that once the enzyme was stabilized, it would be mass produced and then applied in greenhouse farms to speed up absorption of carbon dioxide and regulate the amount in the atmosphere to a more bearable heat intensity for human beings. Meanwhile, as I was doing this, I could not see how carbon dioxide was going to directly impact the lives of people on the continent who at the time were dealing a lot with tropical diseases like malaria. And in Eastern Southern Africa, it was the time of HIV/AIDS. I went to my professor and asked him whether I could not do other research. His response to me was, "Well, we don't have resources for that." And I asked him, "But who allocates and who decides?" He said to me, "It is either the private companies who want to develop scientific products who allocate resources for research, or it's government that has as its policy supporting a particular research line." And in that moment, I knew that I needed to complete the work that I was doing with him and find myself in a career that would enable me to impact policy in ways that I would make a meaningful and direct difference to people whose faces I would see on a day-to-day basis. In the lab, as you know, you work alone, and it seems, while on the one hand, you know, you are doing meaningful work, but I could not connect it to what I had wanted to do, make that impact, and seeing the faces of the people whose lives I would be impacting.
I think many times as Africans, we try to reconcile what the first world or much more developed worlds worry about with our day-to-day. When you see people around you, what can I do to actually impact them directly? And that, I think, is something that you've solved very well from the lab to the humanitarian work that you're doing. that decision to move, you know, into humanitarian work that you are doing at the moment, was it such a like a big cutthroat, this is what I'm doing? Or was it a quiet realization through this process for you to come to that conclusion and move in a different direction?
It felt to me like I needed to honor what felt like a soul's calling. That's what it was for me. And the cost of not doing so would have been too much to bear for me. Such was the intensity of the fire that I felt in my belly. And that's how I completed the work, and I very, very, really clearly in my body and honoring my soul went to do another postgraduate diploma in policy and public administration.
As somebody that loves the mountains as much as I do, I want to ask you the next question in terms of who in your life has been the most amazing shaper, has been an important shaper on your journey to success. Maybe you still are working with them at the moment. Maybe they woke you up to certain realizations that's allowed you to be where you're at. But who is that shaper that's guiding you, that you lean on?
Shaper is such a powerful word, and you know that. And it's good that you mentioned, I do make a distinction between a shaper and what we know every day in our professional lives that we call coaches, which we are, most of us. Because for me, a shaper is somebody who has skill, and a skill that is recognized in the communities where they are, and tenacity. Importantly, it's somebody who has been to the top of their craft and know what it takes to get there, is then available to support others to get to that point and even go beyond. So that's what Sherpa represents for me. I think the word has dimension and depth. Now, coming back to the people who are Sherpas in my life, let me just say my life journey, I would look at my life as a portfolio, and the three most active portfolios at any given point in my time, including up to today, would have been my family, my professional life, as well as my adventures. You just mentioned climbing, because climbing is so integral to my being on a professional level, but to also my contribution to the society. If I am just to speak to one which is linked to my professional life, my former boss, the administrator of the UN Development Programs, also former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Ms. Helen Clark. She is a woman that I observed, that I saw act out in an unapologetic manner. Really ways of bringing women to the table that was admirable. She is the one who is responsible for me being part of UN leadership today. What do I mean by that? She made sure that she casts the net out. She brings to the table women with experience, women who could be out there, be the voice of what the future should be and is, and women who could stand with grace and poise, but still face a world which, for the most part, is still structured in ways that women's voices are not heard. So that's one woman that I would consider my Sherpa, because she has done just that. She didn't do that excluding men. She ensured that we have serious conversations with men. And one thing is that adventures and climbing are so integral to my leadership as well. And Sarah, I have to say, you are one of my Sherpas. Remember, I told you, a Sherpa for me is somebody who has been to the top of their craft, of that mountain. And you have been to the top of the literal mountain the highest one on earth. You are one of the Sherpas that I'm lucky to have in my life. I use climbing to stretch my boundaries and to make a contribution to life. And you will be the first to know that when on the mountain, you cannot fake it. You just have to really act out what the virtues of all that we are embodying in terms of our personal leadership. You cannot talk concepts, you have to live them out. So I would say you are one of those people that are part of my Sherpa world in adventure, contribution, but also enhancing and expanding our leadership because they're all linked.
Thank you for that feedback. I absolutely am honored and humbled. And I find that in your own climbs, you've found a way to pick up leadership lessons and how they embody our day-to-day lives and our leadership styles, which is quite unique. As we move on with our conversation, I would like to take you back to your work as a resident coordinator of the UN reforms in Burkina Faso. Part of your role is to ensure that the systems work for the people. I think which is one thing that you pointed out is the reason you moved from the lab to do what impacts the people. How is that system structured to benefit women in that region specifically?
In any given country, you would have a number of UN specialized entities. You would also have programs and funds that are aligned with the challenges and the priorities of that country. Our countries have to create enabling policy and regulatory environments for women, as they should for the private sector and the broader society. We also look at the financing and resources. What are the instruments that are available for financing of the programs, and what are the channels that ensure that the monies go directly to the women and the people who need them the most, making sure that money is in the hands of the people. Within that, we are working in societies where there are cultural norms and cultural dynamics. We don't turn a blind eye to that. In my case, I'm very, very acutely intentional around that, engaging with the cultural dynamics such that as we are dealing with policy, our programming with the financing that is aligned with empowering women, as an example,
yes,
we also engage the stereotypes in our social environments. All our programs, and I mean every single program, has a gender marker. What I mean by gender marker, you know, when you assess programs, you would assess them for their environmental sustainability. We also have to assess them for the extent to which they take into account the context and the condition of women in the localities where they're being implemented. Of course, we want programs that have high scores. So that's one of the accountability measures for UN leadership. The other one is the resourcing. A certain amount of financing in each of the projects has to be allocated to then driving those results. Now, working with the broader community, government and partners, we have established a pooled fund in Burkina Faso that allows women to submit programs and projects with potential to transform what's happening in the society. And we had to do that because, you know, commercial banks would not do that. Our traditional programs that are, as I mentioned, would not do that. Governments do some things, but they are also limited in the extent to which we can go to scale. The third one, which engages at a society-wide level, brings together youth, men, but still having women's voice heard in their own right, and women. It's what we call Women Leadership Affirmation Forum. We combined that with the campaign of Because I'm a Man. Remember, I said we need to bring men to the table. We have drawn a number of men from different disciplines and different walks of life, and intergenerational as well in terms of age, for them to start speaking out and to say, this is our society. For a young man, what is going to be your role in transforming how you relate to the young girl? For the father, what is going to be your stake in ensuring that your young girl, your girl child, is not treated in a way that reinforces the stereotypes and is supported to go to school. For the uncle, what is your role in talking to your auntie or to the elders in making sure that the young girl is not subjected to female genital mutilation?
Hi, I'm Leanne Williams, Head of Marketing at Vuma. Through Vuma's work of connecting communities, my colleagues and I engage with people from all walks of life, and we know the daily issues that they face. We also understand the roles that connection and connectivity play in driving real change. Connection creates communities. Connectivity creates opportunities for us to achieve greatness together. Visit vumatel.co.za to find out how unlimited access to connectivity can change your world.
So I want to take you a little bit back to combine what you're doing in Burkina Faso and your experience in the South African environment. You know, what are the observations that you've picked up in terms of gender politics in Burkina Faso, in South Africa, and on the continent in general, especially, you know, in West Africa, where we are seeing young girls being kidnapped? What are the observations that you have picked up in your work at the UN?
So what I have observed first is that, of course, women on the continent are not a homogenous group. And yet, there's something very powerful in all the countries I have been to and where I have served. And trust me, I have been to almost all the countries on the continent. You know, women have agency and many are staking their claim. We see it. Women are in leadership in the corporate sector. Women are in leadership in the public sector, but they only represent less than 10% of the society. The majority of countries still has 90% of women, not there yet. And yet we have adopted quotas. Countries have their gender machinery. Countries have policies. Here it is, we're still talking about what needs to be done to bridge the gender gap, to make sure that the girl child goes to school, to make sure that women have access to property rights, to make sure that women actively participate in politics. We are still not there yet. But so these are my observations. And there are serious sticking issues in many of the countries, I would say 80% of the countries. And the two major sticking issues are related to inheritance and property rights, as well as gender-based violence.
It is very sad. I think when I reflect on, especially in the South African environment, women of the 50s walking up to the Union Building and changing our world today, I get challenged every day by what I'm doing today to ensure that that 10% that you are reflecting on is 50% or is 100% to ensure that we actually have a voice that is changing our world and those of girl children coming behind us. So what is your dream, your personal dream for women on the continent?
I think my dream is for every woman to unleash their potential, express the unique gift, their unique selves, and experience their full flourishing in service of their families and the society at large. But for this to happen, we must transform what we have been talking about, the structures, the narratives, and the practices that are holding the society back and that are also stalling the progress towards we have to be at 100%. Men and women have to be actively engaged in these conversations. And I think the single most important thing for us as women is to untangle, you know, the nexus of the intersection, socialization, culture, and interpretation of scriptures, which continue to dishonor women. Once we do that, I think that we will be free as women to confront the challenges without the need to justify a sense of being, and to act with courage and feminine power while also being able to tap into that masculine energy, because we still do need it to operate in this world.
The last question from me, could you describe your best failure and how it propelled you forward?
I think the one that I can think of that is still so vivid in my mind, it was a professional failure. It was a leadership failure in 2017. And I have to tell you, it was my basement moment. I, in my leadership capacity, was expected to present a country strategy to the UN executive board, and I did not. Now, you have to understand that nobody does that. It was a first, not only for the system, but for me, it was a very painful moment. I had, of course, delegated the task to one of our senior managers who was meant to be the pen holder. But that period of drafting the country document coincided with attacks by Al-Qaeda affiliated armed groups in Burkina Faso. What they did was, instead of doing periodic check-ins with the senior director, my attention was turned fully to addressing the humanitarian situation that was unfolding as a result of these attacks. So I did not get a chance to get a feel for the quality and whether we had covered all the bases in the document for it to be presented, because there are standards that we need to meet. And there is a quality that we have to also ensure with all the risks that we have to reflect, whether on the financial side, the operational, or the social side. The week before the presentation, I asked the director to share the document so that I could prepare for the presentation. When I received it, the document was incomplete. Incomplete in terms of the data analysis. He had not integrated the shift in the context with the attacks, and he had not sufficiently shown the risks that we had to account for before allocating resources. So I had two choices: to pretend otherwise and present to the board, or to do the right thing. I chose the latter, meaning to do the right thing. I had to be truthful. I had to come out of the basement and to go to the balcony. And of course, we needed to find a way to make up for time lost by reorganizing ourselves and working on the document. So that was the moment of failure. Not presenting, nobody does that. Just accepting my leadership failure and being truthful to the board, and how it propelled me forward is when I went to the balcony. And the going to the balcony part, from a leadership perspective, I am somebody who truly wants to act with integrity because it's one of my leadership virtues. So the propelling me forward was revealing who I am truly and acting that out in real time. So vis-a-vis the board, I did that. I had to go back to the team. We had a series of conversations. The one conversation that I had with the director, who was the pen holder, I had a conversation for accountability with him, and another one with the team, everybody together, which I called a conversation for possibility. It was important for me to re-engage, create a new narrative, and elevate our vibrancy. And you know, there's a lady called Susan Scott. She talks about fierce conversations, but with commitment. So I just went into, we are going to have these fierce, committed conversations, confront the situation, and come out of it with a breakthrough for ourselves at individual level, for us as a team, and for the document that we needed to finalize.
Metsi, thank you so much for describing the failure. I always say that it's always a failure when you do not learn from it. It sounds like this was failing forward, which is really what life is all about. It's us propelling ourselves into the future with lessons of yesterday, making sure that we don't repeat them, but we use them as stepping stones to get to the top. What I found most interesting about your results and not excuses and explanation, it just took me back to the scientist that you are. Analyze and you must give results and no excuses. What advice would you give to a younger Metsi growing up in Soweto, knowing what you know today?
Young Maxi, I would tell her to trust her voice. She had a very strong inner voice, so to trust it.
Yeah.
To protect her mind. She had thoughts that a way of seeing the world that others could not understand. So to protect her mind and to also nurture her dreams.
That is powerful. And once again, thank you for your time. Thank you for your service at the UN, the work that you've done in the South African environment, and the leadership that will continue to show women that are within your age group and women that are coming behind you. Thank you. And thank you for making the time.
I also want to say a big thanks to you, Sarah, for creating this platform for the many women and out there, the young girls, for being part of transforming that which we need to transform as a society, and also for being one of my sherpas. I look forward to us reconnecting again.
As a Black African female with many aspirations myself, I am well in the know about obstacles that the current world puts in front of me. This is an unending list which includes misogyny, patriarchy, unfair practices in the corporate space, and it goes on and on and on. But just like Maitsi, I realize that my light cannot be dim. I am here to take up space and lead like the Sherpa that I am born to be. My name is Sarah Kumalo, and that was the first episode of Because It's There, a series about climbing the mountain of life, leadership, and the strange and wonderful thing that we call life. Because It's There is produced by Kagiso Mnisi and edited by Kagiso Shabangu.
Because we can, we must. You have the opportunity to create the life you've always imagined when you have unlimited connectivity. Visit vumatel.co.za to check your coverage and get connected to an ISP.